serving Chicago for 100 years, you say?
A century of radio.
Funny you don't look a day over 99.
I've been waiting to use that joke all week.
So we've played this song, this Chariots of Fire song, a million times for all of the marathons and all the things that have gone on through the years. This past week, the artist that performs this song, Vangelis,
passed away. Yeah.
So we send our best wishes and condolences to his family. And it ties in because we have something going on this morning, don't we?
The spring half marathon. And I haven't heard a complaint from you yet.
Where is everybody?
Yeah, I was expecting there to be a little more traffic in the area.
Okay, here's the deal.
I see a thing out there this morning. This will be at least 2 hours of things me complaining about today.
That's because...
I got nothing today. There's nothing to complain about.
That's because...
Except that I didn't see anybody.
That's because it's all south of us. And just south of us, because we're on Wacker, and as Andy and I both encountered, Columbus closed up to Randolph Street through Grant Park and down to Roosevelt. But the actual course runs up Columbus and then along Lakeshore Drive, DeSable Lakeshore Drive, and then just goes south from there.
Back on Lakeshore Drive?
Yeah, back onto Lakeshore Drive.
So wait a minute. I've been complaining about this for 25 years.
This is the half marathon, though.
That they should just go from one end to the other, and that's what they did with this one? Are you trying to tell me that someone listened to me?
Only half.
And if that's,
only half, yes.
If that's the case, we are in much bigger trouble than we thought. If anyone is paying attention to what I'm saying.
Yeah, it runs down DeSable Lakeshore Drive down to around 47th and Lake Park, that area there, a little bit south, and then they turn around.
Right on Lakeshore Drive, not on Lakeshore Drive.
On the sidewalk there, the walkway there, yes. And then up to Grant Park, and then the finish line is just north of Monroe, right where would be the southeast corner of Millennium Park, where you go up into the Lurie Garden area there.
Yeah.
That's where the end would be. It started just south of there, but that's where the end of the half marathon is today.
This is a dream come true for me.
You don't need the secret route to work.
I didn't.
You don't need the underground tunnel that you've dug.
Skycam 9. I'd like have to drop you off here.
Dean Richards bunker that I started many years ago. It's all the things I've been complaining about all these years. That why don't you make it a straight line, inconvenience as few people as possible. And that's what they did.
Well, we can take this a step further now. Since this is a half marathon, you go down to around 47th, then come back up.
Yep.
If you want to do the whole marathon in October, just run the course twice.
Just keep going south
to
Indiana.
Or just keep going south, yeah.
Don't stop till you get to Indianapolis. Well,
and then the finish line will be at Hammond and 106th Street.
At the White Castle. It'll be at the White Castle than Hammond. What a better place to end a marathon than at a White Castle.
State Line Road and Indianapolis Boulevard.
Is that what it is?
Okay. Yes.
All right. That's got to be about 26 miles, I would think, right?
Pretty close.
Something like that.
Pretty close.
You got to run another 26 after eating at White
Castle.
But
then you've got to come back.
All right. Now listen, I'm nothing but full of great ideas here. So
he's full of mirth and merriment and good cheer this morning, Andy. This bodes well for us.
I've noticed, yes.
Now, do you notice we have no answer to that?
It's okay.
I was surprised when I didn't see anybody down here today.
I actually was myself.
I expected it was going to be trouble getting into the building and parking and street closures and the whole rigmarole that I've been complaining about as long as I can remember.
I did have a slightly alternate route this morning. It was not a big deal
because you are south.
I'm south.
You're
right.
South of...
So I was affected by these closures in Grant Park.
Schwanee lives right near the White Castles in Hammond.
Not that far south.
That's what the reason many of you have asked, why does he always smell like steamed onions? That would be the reason why.
And the 1921 burger that they're advertising.
What is that?
It's their 100th anniversary.
Is everybody jumping on the 100th anniversary bandwagon with us?
A lot of companies have been doing this, yes.
So what's the 1921 burger?
I guess it's their burger that they initiated when they started in the early 1920s.
And how is it different from the 2022 burger?
It may not be any different at all. I don't know. I've just seen the signs on various White Castles that I've driven by. I haven't tried it yet. So maybe we can get an answer from someone who would know more about this.
1921 burger.
The Google machine always knows.
Let's see here. Oh, it's a premium grilled burger.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if we've got... the 1921 slider, 100% beef patty, seared and seasoned, topped with caramelized onion, cheddar cheese, Roma tomato, lettuce, pickles, inspired by the one that started it all, is what it says on the website.
Right,
I don't like it.
What do you mean you don't like it? You haven't even tried it.
I like my sliders classic.
Oh, okay. Well.
Mushy, wet bread.
The steamed onions.
I like the steamed onions. And really, is there anything better than steamed beef? Grilled and seared. Fancy pants, White Castles.
Grilled and seared to order.
Ooh.
To taste.
Yeah. I wonder how much it is. Let's see if we can see how much this is. What's a slider go for these days?
I'm not sure.
I haven't
had one in years. Yeah.
That's because we're so fancy.
I think it's been 8-10 years since I've had White Castle. I was in Indianapolis late one night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
late. My eyes beheld an eerie sight.
Late one night is usually in the same sentences. I went to White Castles.
Yes. Yes. And that's the last time I had them. But they did not have the 1921 burger there in 2012.
You know, this website's too difficult to... you know, White Castles is getting too difficult. I just want to know the price. That's all I want to know.
That should be on their website.
They want my zip code. They want my... I just want to know the price. I don't need to give you my tax information.
I was going to say, did they want your tax return next?
Please enter your address. I'm not getting engaged to them.
Number of years you've lived at the current residence.
Please submit your W-2 forms. What?
We would also need a utility bill and your birth certificate.
Now, turns out I don't care that much, but I'm just curious. Anyway, well, congratulations to them and everybody else celebrating a 100th birthday, which seems to be everybody these days. Very, very nice. It's 9:16. You know who we have on the show today? I'm very excited. Richard Thomas is going to be on today. Richard Thomas, who played John Boy Schwani on The Waltons.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Good night, John Boy.
Good night, John Boy. I wonder how many times that poor man has heard that
in his life.
Every single place that he goes, somebody must say good night, John Boy, to him. A la the famous closing of the
Waltons, the show.
He's in To Kill a Mockingbird. He plays Atticus Finch in the stage production of To Kill a Mockingbird that's at the Nederlander Theater right now. And it is so good. It was great to just see a straightaway play, number one. But he is so good in this. This production is so good. This, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird is the story of a small-town southern lawyer who defends an African-American man who has been accused of raping a white woman. So the story of racial inequity and bigotry and hate, sadly, could not be more timely of what we're still going through after all these years. But it is so well performed. Can't recommend it enough. And I'm excited that we're going to talk with Richard Thomas today.
Now, it's not there all that long, is it? The engagement is just a few weeks.
I think we've got maybe a couple of more weeks, maybe a week. I'd have to look. Wait, I have the notes right here. You know, Shawnee, there's a fair amount of preparation that goes into putting on a program such as this.
Well, I've thought that, you know, you were going to interview the star of the show, that you would know
right off the top of my
head how long it would be running.
Yeah, well, and I have it here in my notes, so I only have so much room left in my memory, so I'll try not to crowd it with things I don't really need long term. May 29th is when it actually closes.
Okay, yes. That's coming up.
Yeah, so there's still time to go see it. And I'm excited. We're going to talk with him on our theater segment this morning at 10:35. Also, we had a nice visit with a PBS chef, Diane Kouchilas. She does the show called My Greek Table on PBS and has written 18 cookbooks on Greek and Mediterranean cooking. And we had her on the TV morning show with me on Friday. And she cooked for me, and I cooked for her. We had a little Greek cook-off.
Yeah, what did you end up making for her?
I wound up making what I am calling Greek paella.
Oh.
Greek paella.
Greek paella?
Now, do you know that paella, you think of it as the Spanish dish, which that's what it's called, paella. But the word paella in Espanol is actually the name of the pan.
Oh.
It's a short pan. Short pan is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I took my, I went and got me one of them short pans. It was paella pans. And I created, you know, I made it with the Greek ingredients. I did a Greek rice pilaf as the base, not a saffron rice like it would be in a Spanish paella. Greek pilaf, kind of a lemon rice almost. I roasted some vegetables until they were nice and caramelized and delicious. I put that into the mixture, and instead of, you could do it with seafood, you could do it with chicken, you could do it with sausage, the way traditional paellas are, but because I was trying to make a Greek paella, and because Diane Kouchilas' sponsor is Grecian Delight Gyros, I was trying to incorporate her sponsor's product into my dish. So I put gyros in it also. It was very good. Really, it was beautiful in the nice big paella pan, and it was quite delicious.
Did she like it?
She loved it.
Good.
Yeah, she said she was going to steal my recipe. So I've got my lawyers ready for that.
For a price, you can have it.
For it, yeah. that's an honor that she said she wanted to steal my recipe. And it's also super easy to make. But anyway, we're going to have Diane Kouchilas joining us on the show today as well. So I'm looking forward to that. You know what I'm really looking forward to on today's program?
What's that?
It's a little thing we call the far-flung forecast.
Oh, yeah, that.
It's America's favorite feature. Ask anyone in any of our 50 states, from sea to shining sea. They'll tell you, my favorite feature is the far-flung forecast, the weekly compendium of interesting facts and figures, and all compiled by the one and only Dave Stavros Schwann.
Well, thank you very much, Uncle Dean, and good morning, everyone. Today we go to Little Falls, Minnesota.
Little Falls, Minnesota.
Little Falls, Minnesota.
Would that be L-I-T-T-L-E or L-I-L?
No, not little. L-I-T-T-L-E.
Right.
Little Falls, okay. Minnesota. In the central part of the state.
I know they're a big fan of Lil Nas X.
Little Falls, Minnesota.
Lil Wayne, Lil Jon.
Little Falls, Minnesota.
All the little rappers, I know they're big fans of.
Population 9,140.
Quaint.
And the name comes from the fact that it was settled by a place along the Mississippi that had little falls in the water.
Wait a minute.
Little falls, waterfalls in the river as it goes by where the town is.
Yeah.
But Little Falls, or Little Falls, Minnesota, is the boyhood home of Charles A. Lindbergh.
Hmm.
And it was on last Friday's date and it was great. 95 years ago, on May 20th, 1927, that Charles A. Lindbergh took off from Roosevelt Field on Long Island, New York, for the world's first solo nonstop flight between New York and Paris.
How about that?
May 20th, 1927, the plane barely made it off the runway, and he flew 33 and a half hours before landing at Le Bourget Field in Paris, the first pilot to accomplish that solo nonstop transatlantic crossing. He was so tired at the end, he was holding his eyelids open.
My arms are exhausted.
Yeah. he was holding his eyelids open with his fingers. But he was raised in Low Falls, Minnesota, who has sunny skies and 47 today.
On a related note, it was on this day in 1906 that the Wright brothers got a patent for what was called their flying machine.
Their flying machine, the aeroplane.
The flying machine. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever gone to the National Space Museum in Washington?
No, I haven't, and I should. Oh, I would also like to go to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina.
Yeah, that would be, that's that both, I'm sure, very cool. I've never gone to Kitty Hawk, but I've been to this space museum.
Oh, yeah, I remember you coming back and just couldn't say enough of it.
I loved it. You would love it because the actual Kitty Hawk is there. The Wright brothers plane is there.
Yeah.
The Lindbergh plane.
Yeah.
Spirit of St. Louis? Is that
the Spirit of St. Louis?
Is
yes.
That
that's
yeah,
right.
That's
he was a mail delivery pilot.
Yeah. Many of the early space missions, the Apollo capsules are there, and
I would imagine Apollo 11, maybe 13 would be there too.
Yeah, you can just go right up to them. And you know, you're like an inch away from all of them. It's fantastic and really cool. But happy anniversary to the Wright brothers as well for their patent.
You know, think about this.
They also didn't serve peanuts on that flight.
No, nothing was served on that flight. But 1927, that's only 42 years before we're walking on the moon. Think
crazy?
About that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. May 20th, 1927 was Charles Lindbergh's flight, who was born and raised in Low Falls, Minnesota.
It's 9:37 now, and this is Dean Richards, Sunday morning on WGN. Always look forward to chatting with our pal, Dr. Kevin Most, Chief Medical Officer, Northwestern Central DuPage Hospital. Dr. Most, good morning to you, my friend.
Good morning, Dean. How are you guys doing this morning?
We are doing fine, but tons of questions. Right when we hoped that things would be leveling off with COVID, Chicago Tribune writes, the Chicago area is expected to increase to a high community level of COVID-19 next week as positive cases continue to rise across the city and suburbs. Do you think that is also a probability?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a probability. And in fact, if we did not have home testing, we would already be at that level. Everyone has to remember that, you know, the test rates that they're talking about are those that are done in the private sector, essentially the public sector, versus those that are done in the privacy of their individual's home, where we don't capture that result. So certainly it's a little bit alarming because, as you remember, just a few weeks ago, Chicago, the city of Chicago, was still in low, where the collar counties were in moderate. And it'll soon be where we are all at high. So people have to understand it's still out there. We just kind of let a lot of our mitigation, you know, fall to the wayside.
Time magazine, they're doing an exceptional job of covering COVID. By the way, if you're interested in the subject, take a look online at what Time magazine is writing. But what they are saying is basically the same thing, only from a national perspective. That people are testing positive again at alarmingly high rates. So I guess the question is, you know, how do we try to stem this? Do we go back to social distancing? Do we go back to mask mandates? Do we go back to, you know, keeping our distance from certain sectors of people?
Yeah, Dean, it's interesting. I think we've almost taken it as we're accepting this illness now, because when we use the mask mandate, talk about that topic, when would we trigger that again? Not until there was a burden in the hospitals. So the public burden is still going to be high, but if it's not stressing the healthcare system, we're going to continue to allow it. But think about when we were in the middle of this, you never would have thought about shaking hands with somebody, giving them a hug, you know, washing your hands like every couple minutes. All those things that's really slowed down the spread of this illness are gone. I do think that we're going to see the spread, and it's going to continue, and we're probably going to get a summer bump instead of a fall bump.
So I'm not sure I'm hearing what you're recommending. I mean, it sounds like you're saying it's your own personal choice as to whether or not you want to go back to some of these protections, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to have Big Brother saying, we'll say the government. I don't think you're going to see the government saying you're going back to mask mandates. It'll be interesting to see what they do with public transportation. There's such a lobbyist group out there to continue it the way it is now, where it's optional, that I don't think that will push. I would say, if you're immunocompromised, if you live with someone who's immunocompromised, you know, if you're over the age of 65, I certainly would say continue to be careful. Hospitalizations are down, but they are still present. And I can tell you, the people that are getting this, they're sick. They may not be sick enough to be in the hospital, but just talk to any of your friends that have it. Certainly, you're going to have those that say, oh, it was just a mild cold. But you're going to have others that say, I was pretty knocked out for a good 5, 6, 7 days.
Right. Yeah, that's what I've been hearing. And more, suddenly I know lots of people who have tested positive, coworkers and, you know, friends and, you know, people who are just out of the blue. I mean, they escaped it for the entire duration of the pandemic. And now when masks are coming down and people are shaking hands and hugging is taking place, as you say, all, you know, like kind of life as we once knew it, you know, people are testing positive and they're down for the count for about a week or so. Are we still seeing seniors as the biggest candidate for this now? Are we still seeing immunocompromised people? Or are there other age groups now that are more greatly affected by this?
Well, as far as greatly affected, we're really seeing that 20 to 40-year-old group, that very socially active group, are the ones that are really starting to test positive quite a bit. The good thing about seniors is the vast majority of them have been not only vaccinated, oh, well over 90%, but over 75% of them have actually been boosted as well.
Yeah.
So those are the individuals that see this as a threat of my life and a threat to my well-being, and they're doing it. Well, we have the 20 to 40-year-old saying, well, you know what, it's going to be a bad cold. It's going to be here forever. Let's just get used to it. And that, you know, the dichotomy of the two choices or the two differences are what's kind of concerning, as we're still trying to protect that population, and yet we have a large swath of the population that says, hey, it's here forever. Let's just live with it.
So I've noticed the people are not cleaning, like, you know, in public places, in the workplace, I guess you might say, is where really I notice it most. During the pandemic, we would all come to our workplace and scrub down our work area, the computer, keyboard, the desk area, everything, the telephone, make sure that everything's nice and clean. People are not doing that as much now. I wonder if that is contributing to it. But on the other hand, you've told us so many times that this virus does not live on surfaces, that, you know, that's what we thought in the beginning, but is not the case now. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, the transmissibility of this off of a surface or off of an object is extremely low. But I can tell you, those same individuals that are cleaning their office like that are also washing their hands, are also making sure that they're distanced. They are that mindset of, hey, this is still serious. Let's take care of it that way. You know, I don't see people saying, you know what, I'm going to wash down my work site, but then I am not going to wash my hands. I'm not going to shake, you know, and I'm still going to shake hands and give hugs. Those are the people that actually are going to stay safe. I'm not sure we're going to ever actually continue to minimize the spread of this. I think we have too much widespread lack of mitigation throughout the country that we're not going to slow it down. Look, we're in the middle of wedding season, right? It's like there's a wedding every other hour out here, and it's those individuals that are going to become, I don't want to say super spreader events, but certainly ones where the virus is going to have a greater opportunity to spread.
847 area code asks, should I feel confident swimming in an outside swimming pool?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're outside, that's great. And the beauty of swimming is not only is it great exercise for you, great for your joints and your heart and all that, but you really can't get close to anybody when you're swimming, right? So, you know, being outside in a pool is great. that's one thing we have going for us, is the weather finally is allowing us to get outside and getting us away from those enclosed spaces. But certainly going to a pool is a great idea. You can distance, and you're going to get good exercise that's not going to be disruptive to your knees and back and things that like running and heavy walking would do.
I might have asked that same question, though, with, you know, people spitting in the pool. And, you know, there's a lot floating around in that pool that I might be concerned about.
There is, but you have to remember that those pools are heavily chlorinated so that no bacteria actually live in those. You know, that's why the water is so clear, and sometimes why your skin gets irritated after swimming, because we really have put safeguards in to make sure that the pools are safe from a public health point of view to begin with.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and get to some more questions for Dr. Kevin Most. It is 9:50, and this is Dean Richards Sunday Morning. Actor Richard Thomas coming up in about a half an hour, starring in To Kill a Mockingbird, the cast of Downton Abbey later on. And Dr. Kevin Most, Chief Medical Officer, Central DuPage Hospital, on with us right now. Dr. Most, how concerned should we be with the monkeypox that we're hearing about all the time?
Well, it's really interesting, Dean. You know, anytime you get a monkeypox case anywhere in the world, it kind of gets everyone's attention. And certainly this outbreak of about 20 monkeypox cases, but if they've been across the world, I mean, been in UK, Spain, France, Canada, Italy. So it's not like there's this big outbreak. And it's not like we have found that the monkeypox that they have identified has mutated and is any more contagious. So certainly not a big concern for people. I think it's more of a interest to the public health people and interest to researchers, but nothing where I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to start exploding with growth. You know, we've been talking about, we in the medical field have known about this for about a month now. So certainly nothing that has continued to spread where we're having outbreaks of it. We're having rare cases. And the interesting thing is we can't trace it back as to travel. We can't trace it back as to how these individuals contacted each other. So it's interesting, but I wouldn't be concerned about it at all.
Boy, we slam right into panic mode, though, right, when we hear about something these days.
Right.
You know, because we think, oh, boy, now what? Now what are we going to deal with? Lori is on the phone at 312-981-7200. Lori, you're on with Dr. Kevin Most on WGN.
Good morning. You know, you mentioned earlier, Dr. Most, that people are kind of ready to just learn to live with COVID. I'm fully vaccinated, twice boosted. I work in a school district where we get daily reports who has COVID. Most people are vaccinated and they're getting it, but they're not terribly sick. So my question to you is, what is wrong with just everybody going ahead and getting COVID? I don't mean everybody, but, you know, those who are vaccinated. Because you're only sick, you know, for a few days. I get the flu shot every year. Sometimes I get the flu, sometimes I don't. So I'm just curious, at what point do we say that we have the herd immunity and then it's okay?
Yeah, Lori, so you asked the question. The way you asked it was very interesting, right? You get a report out every day of who has COVID. Now, I don't know what the impact has been and the school district workforce, but I can tell you in the hospital workforce, it's something we watch every day. So last week, you know, our hospital had 60 people out with COVID. So fielding a team to make sure that you have high quality individuals in the workplace, whether it's manufacturing, school, healthcare, is probably one of our biggest concerns here. So that is one of the things. Living with it is one thing, and we have to understand then that we're going to have an impact on the economy. But I still come back to, if we're not going to do what we can to protect those who are immunocompromised and elderly, what's our thought process there? Why aren't we going to do this to protect somebody who's over 70 so that they can make it to 95 versus saying, you know what, this is just something we're going to have. Let's just live with it. And it's Darwinism. It's the survival of the fittest. And I just think that the vaccine and public health should be able to extend everyone's lives and not just at the convenience of those who want it.
Lori,
that's just my personal opinion.
Thank you for your call. Lori, 773 area code texts. I take CTA buses and most don't wear masks. Am I safe if I am masked?
Well, you are. At least you have some protection. If you're vaccinated and masked, certainly you do have. You know, the public transportation, especially in CTA buses where, you know, they can be quite crowded. You know, in airports, certainly there's areas of being crowded, but that's one of the reasons that we had the mask mandate on there. So there are two things with the mask. If you remember, initially, we were putting that on to protect others from us. And then we did the studies. We actually show that the masking actually does help protect us for a couple of reasons. One, it doesn't allow you to, you know, take things in real easily if you were exposed to somebody. Two, probably one of the biggest things, is it stops you from touching your nose and mouth, which is one of the ways we get infected after coughing in our hand, shaking someone's hand, we touch our mouth or face. So certainly wearing a mask, although you may feel a little bit unusual, I would say you're doing the right thing for yourself and for those around you.
Rose is on 312-981-7200. Rose, you're on WGN.
Well, good morning. First of all, thank you for being there, Dr. Mohsen Dean. We just enjoy your program. My question is about my husband, who has a cold. It started last Sunday. Sinus issue, no temperature, and I think he's at the end of it, but he is overdue for his booster, which he had, the last one was in January. So how soon would he be able to get the booster? I'd send him out tomorrow if I could, but he's not, we've tested him, he doesn't have COVID this time.
Okay. When you say you'd send him out tomorrow, Rose, you mean you'd send him out to get his booster, not just you'd send him out, right?
All right. We're not going to say on radio which one it is.
Okay. Depends on the day, probably.
Right. Oh, totally.
Right. So your husband right now, if he just has a good spring cold, you know, probably adenovirus or rhinovirus, the immune system is trying to fight that off. If his symptoms are resolving now, I would say this time next week, he would be good to get that booster and know that booster will start working within the next week or so. So certainly tell him to be really careful these next couple of days, wash his hands, but allow the immune system to fight off the rhinovirus that he has right now and then get the booster here in about, 5 to 7 days.
5 to 7 days. Great.
Yep.
Rose, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Dr. Kevin Most, thank you, my friend, and I hope you have a wonderful Sunday today. Thank you.
You got it, Dean. Take care.
I think enough time has passed that I could steal this to become the theme song for this show.
That's the original version, too.
Oh, here we go. Here he goes on a little jazz riff here. There we go. Remember I interviewed Severinsen? I almost said Dr. Kevin Most.
Dr. Kevin Most. does Dr. Most play trumpet, too?
How did I never call Doc Severinsen for COVID advice?
I remember you, the interview with Doc Severinsen, yes.
That's when Antenna TV started carrying the Johnny Carson shows, weeknights at 9. Still fun to watch, by the way. And the reason that I'm playing this is that today is the 30th anniversary of when Johnny Carson went off the air.
Oh, okay.
When Johnny Carson said his final goodbye.
May of 1992, yes.
May 22nd, bum, bum, 1992, Johnny sat on that stool and gave us a very heartfelt goodbye.
And a tearful farewell, too, at the end.
Yeah.
I still have that on a VHS cassette somewhere.
Is that right?
Yes.
You still have a VHS player?
Yes, I do.
Wow.
Yes, I do. Done with that, VHS? I play my 78 RPM records.
Beta. Do you have Beta?
No, it was VHS. I had a friend who had Beta, though.
It's one of those that has the remote control via the wire that's connected to the actual unit.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it's not that old. Okay. I got rid of that one.
I have in my, I think I've mentioned this on the air, I have in my office at home, I have a museum of obsolete electronics. You know, things that I bought that you can't even buy stuff for them anymore to try to fix them or use them. I have my VHS player. I have a VHS player that also has a DVD player.
Ooh. Oh, wow. You can do two.
All in one. So when one breaks down, the whole thing is useless. Genius thought he was like, I'm just going to buy one thing to replace both.
I sure enjoyed the display of the marvelous vintage equipment here in the hallway here at the station,
right.
Celebrating our 100th anniversary.
Yeah, most of that equipment we still use, by the way. We just have never updated.
Oh, analog VU meters.
I have an 8-track player at home. I have reel-to-reel player.
I do, too. It needs work, but I have it.
Right? No dork who was in radio that didn't have a reel-to-reel player at home. I've got all this obsolete stuff that I haven't touched in decades. I haven't touched it, but it's part of my ute.
Yeah, I have a mini disc player at home because we used to use that on interviews when I was doing Cubs games. We would do the interviews on mini disc, and I also now you could put your iPod into it because that's toast.
Right? Yeah, those you know, and everybody thought, wow, this is the future. I can put my whole music library on one of these little iPods. Carry that around, and nobody has those anymore. Can you even buy those anymore?
I think they just went out of production, I think, a couple weeks ago,
Sad. That's sad. It doesn't seem like that long ago, does it? 30 years that Johnny Carson went off the air? It completely seems like just yesterday, and still is one of the great sign-offs, I think, of all time.
And so it has come to this. I am one of the lucky people in the world. I found something I always wanted to do, and I have enjoyed every single minute of it. I want to thank the gentleman who shared this stage with me for 30 years, Mr. Ed McMahon.
Mr. Doc Severinsen.
You people watching, I can only tell you that it has been an honor and a privilege to come into your homes all these years and entertain you. And I hope when I find something that I want to do and I think you will like and come back, that you'll be as gracious inviting me into your home as you have been. I bid you a very heartfelt good night.
That's classy right there. That is the definition of classy.
It is. And he never really did much else. He just kind of went into obscurity.
He chose not to. He went into retirement. Unlike almost everybody that goes into retirement and then they pop up on other things, he pretty much did not. He did one cameo appearance on David Letterman when Dave was in, you know, how he would do a show from Los Angeles once in a while. Johnny did a quick cameo where he brought a little portable desk out. And he pretended to be the host of the show. And then he set up this little portable desk. The audience was going wild. He took the portable desk and he left. That's all there was. That was his whole
portable desk.
But it's great. These old reruns of Carson on antenna TV. It's really fun to see the master at work with the the monologue. But I look at him as the master interviewer. You know, as somebody that spends a lot of my time interviewing other people, I look to see how Johnny did it. And it's a master class, really, to watch him do that.
It is. And also could be just the best at coming back with a one-liner, you know, with a one-line singer.
Sometimes not even that. Sometimes just a raised eyebrow to the camera. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or just that look that he would give.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he truly, truly was the greatest of all time. So it's kind of a bittersweet anniversary. And think of all that's happened in late night TV since Johnny retired 30 years ago. The Jay Leno, David Letterman battle, Conan O'Brien on in late night, Arsenio Hall in late night. I mean, it's come and gone. The Daily Show, name them. They've all come and gone from late night TV. Nobody really has had that kind of impact that that Johnny Carson did through the years. It's very interesting right now with Stephen Colbert, with Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon. Most of the time, Stephen Colbert wins the ratings battle at night. Jimmy Kimmel does often as well. Fallon, not so much as when the whole thing started. I think the way people watch television is changing.
Oh yeah,
drastically.
Yeah, I think how people are entertaining themselves. The idea that everybody goes to a late night talk show these days, I don't think that's the case anymore.
There was a time also when Johnny Carson was on where both of the competing networks, CBS and ABC, had competing late night shows. Joey Bishop on ABC and for a while Merv Griffin on CBS.
Merv Griffin, yeah. Didn't Pat Sajak have a late night?
He may have had one for a minute. Yeah.
Show also.
Yeah.
Bob Costas had one too.
Bob Costas had, that was like a late thing,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
He's great. He's one that I admire greatly as an interviewer as well. It's been a lot. And some television history was made last night as well when four members of Saturday Night Live signed off. Kate McKinnon signed off after about 10 years on Saturday Night Live. They wrote a sketch in which she was abducted by aliens, and you know, that was sort of her send-off. Adi Bryant, who is great on that show, is also leaving SNL. And Pete Davidson is also saying goodbye. Pete Davidson, one of the youngest members ever, cast members on Saturday Night Live, and certainly one that's garnered, probably the most attention after he was engaged to Ariana Grande after dating her for only 2 weeks. His personal life, his love life has been well documented in headlines, his struggles with depression and addiction, well documented, his father dying at the World Trade Center on 9/11, well documented. But he appeared on Weekend Update last night, and he also said goodbye, thanking the producer of the show, the very well-known Lorne Michaels.
He's led us through the COVID era, even though the only time he wears a mask is at his Eyes Wide Shut parties. There you go.
Sure.
Yeah.
They got there.
He always gives the best advice, really. This is all true advice that Lorne's given me. I'll never forget this. I called him and said, when I got engaged, I said, Lorne, I just got engaged to Ariana Grande after dating for 2 weeks. And he said, oh, hold on for dear life. It's a true thing he said. And then I remember when I auditioned for SNL, he looked me right in the eye and said, I don't know if, I don't think you're right for this show. So let's screw this up together. And that's exactly what we did. And that's why people who don't think I deserve this job shouldn't hate me, since we have so much in common. Like, if anything, I should inspire hope, you know, like that literally anyone could be on Saturday Night Live. Seriously, you see a guy bumming cigarettes outside of 7-Eleven at 2 a.m.? That's not some meth head. That's the next Pete Davidson.
Well, I'm going to miss you, Pete.
Oh, well, thanks, Colin, even though I know it says that on your cue card. You've been like an older brother to me in that, you know, in the way that my mom openly loves you more than she does me. And I appreciate SNL always having my back and allowing me to work on myself and grow. And, you know, thank you to Lorne for never giving up on me or, you know, judging me even when like everyone else was, and for believing in me and allowing me to have a place that like I could call home with the memories that'll last a lifetime. So thank you guys.
Pete Davidson, everyone.
Yeah, it was nice. A nice, heartfelt sign-off. I think he's very funny. He's, you know, given us lots of good movies. That's what he's going to concentrate on. Kate McKinnon will be concentrating on motion pictures. Adi Bryant, ditto, as will continue to work on motion pictures, her series that has been running. And who else? I'm blanking on the name of the. Oh, Kyle Mooney. Kyle Mooney. Yeah, it was also kind of like an understated character on the show. He also signed off for the final time last night. So it's going to be a whole new SNL when it comes back in the fall. Very interesting. 10:19 is the time. Did you have a favorite cast members of Saturday Night Live through the years? I mean, this show has a 47-year history. Do you have favorites? Do you go back to the early days for your favorites of Belushi and Gilda Radner? Do you go
Eddie Murphy
a little further? Eddie Murphy's fantastic.
Piscopo.
Really? Oh, yeah, he was hotter than anything.
Yep.
Back in the day, that's for sure. Kristen Wiig was always one of my super favorites on the show. How about you? 312-981-7200. Get into our theater segment in a couple of minutes. Today we're going to be talking about The Looking Glass Alice over at the Looking Glass Theater. That is part live production, part circus. Very interesting concept. Also, though, we'll be joined by Richard Thomas. You know him probably best as John Boy from The Waltons. He's appeared recently on Ozark and many, many, many productions. He's currently starring as Atticus Finch in the production of To Kill a Mockingbird, which is at the Niederlander Theater through 1 week from today, through the 29th, and it's highly recommended. They do such an amazing, amazing job in telling this classic Harper Lee story from 1960 that sadly still rings true today about racial disparity and just plain old bigotry and hatred toward one another in different races. Richard Thomas joining us after the 10:30 newscast. In the meantime, talking a little about Saturday Night Live, all the cast members that signed off for the final time last night. And I was just wondering who some of your favorites have been. On our text line so far, 312-981-7200, by the way, if you'd like to get on the phone line or text. But on our text line right now, overwhelmingly, people talking about Phil Hartman as being their favorite on the show. And what amazing characters Phil Hartman gave us through the years, that's for sure. Kenan Thompson also mentioned. He is the cast member with the greatest longevity of any cast member. He's been on the show longer than anybody on that show. People mentioning Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, a classic era on that show. Seth Meyers, who was the Weekend Update host for a long time. Billy Crystal, Mike Myers, and Dana Carvey both mentioned. Wayne's World was born out of that. Gilda Radner, of course, John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, among the names that are being texted in. But Ken, you go along with the Phil Hartman, right, as one of the greatest characters ever on SNL. I think I have to agree with that.
You know, I just watched it last night. It's ironic. I have the DVDs, and his skit when he plays President Clinton and goes into McDonald's and starts talking about all the warlords and eating the food is just a magnificent scene.
I remember him as Frankenstein, where he didn't really do anything but grunt.
But
weren't they singing were they singing a Christmas carol or something? I'm trying to remember. It was like several classic horror movie characters, and he played Frankenstein, and all he did was the Frankenstein grunt, and he was absolutely hilarious.
And some of the finest comedy of not really having any lines, but just the acting alone was enough to make it funny.
Yeah.
So.
Yep, I agree. That's a great choice. I appreciate your call. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, dude. Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Oh, here's, of course, 708, remembering the great Tim Kazurinsky, Chicago's very own, still very active in theater and all kinds of endeavors here in the Chicago area. And I remember, of course, the commentary is that Tim used to do with the chimpanzee and reacting to a very unpredictable chimpanzee. Absolute complete genius. 815 area code, remembering Julia Louis-Dreyfus. We have some here remembering, let me see, Martin Short. Martin Short wasn't on SNL for a very long time, but he definitely left a mark there. He was part of the Second City TV cast, which was also fantastic and legendary in its own way. I think everybody, they wanted to be on SNL. That was the high point of a lot of comedians' career. 847, remembering that Phil Hartman also did the caveman lawyer character. That's right. He gave us some fantastic characters and tragically died way, way, way too young. So anyway, we're, just remembering some of the characters on SNL that we've said goodbye to, including Pete Davidson, who in a very short time definitely made his mark. Kate McKinnon, who is, one of the great standout players of all time. Adie Bryant, for sure. And, we'll see what comes next. People still remember Father Guido Sarducci. Wow. There's a name from the past. How about that? Father Guido Sartucci was hilarious. Gilda Radner, Lorraine Newman, the church lady. Remember the church lady? That was Dana Carvey's famous character. And the 224 area code also remembering Joe Piscopo. He made his mark on that show. He very most definitely did. All right, let's take a quick break and get updated for the news. And then when we come back from all of that, we will be talking with Richard Thomas, starring in To Kill a Mockingbird here in Chicago. Stick around. It is 10:37. This is Dean Richards, Sunday morning on WGN. And this week on our Weekend Theater segment, we focus in on one of the classics in American literature and American stage, To Kill a Mockingbird. Set in Alabama in 1934, it is Harper Lee's story of racial injustice and childhood innocence that even though the book itself was first released in 1960, sadly still rings true today in the year 2022, and all focusing on a small-time lawyer by the name of Atticus Finch.
When I was a boy, my father gave me one of those air rifles, an air rifle. He said he'd rather I shoot at tin cans in the backyard, but that he knew one day the temptation would become too great and I'd want to shoot at birds. He said I could shoot all the blue jays I want, probably knowing I'd never be able to hit one, but to always remember that it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Pivotal moment in this amazing production that's now being staged at the Niederlander Theater here in Chicago through 1 week from today, May 29th, and starring Richard Thomas, who you know from so many different productions in motion pictures and in television, and probably know best from the long-running The Waltons on television as John Boy. It's a pleasure to welcome Richard Thomas to the program. Richard, I cannot even tell you how moved I was seeing your performance in To Kill a Mockingbird the other night.
Dean, thank you so much. Happy Sunday. It's great to be with you. I appreciate your kind words.
Happy Sunday to you, and thank you for bringing these words back. You know, maybe more poignant than ever, sadly, in this world in which we're living now, right?
What? I know. I mean, it's a privilege to be bringing the show around the country. Aaron Sorkin has done such an amazing job of adapting Harper Lee's book, and you know, he's created such a rich Atticus Finch for the stage, and so it's just been not only delightful for the actor, but also a privilege to just bring this subject matter around the country, because sadly, what you say is absolutely true. You know, it's a picture of us as we were in 1934, but it's also in large measure a picture of us as we are today.
Yeah, I wonder if Harper Lee could have ever possibly imagined when this book came out in 1960, you know, it may be one of the worst parts of violations of civil rights in America for African-American mm-hmm. people, that all these years later, we'd still be dealing with exactly the same issues of, you know, racial injustice and prejudice and hatred and voter inequity. Every single thing could have been ripped from yesterday's headlines.
She would probably have hoped that the book would no longer be relevant, but part of her, I'd imagine, would have imagined that it was. I mean, it is such a picture of us as a people, and the distance between our aspirations and the reality of our lives, you know. And one of the beautiful things about the story is that even though it does show us how short we fall from what we aspire to, that the aspiration and the attempt to do the good and do the right thing is always with us, so we shouldn't ever give up on that.
You know? Yeah,
and it's a beautiful story about children, about raising kids and about kids growing up and the loss of innocence, not only for the Finch kids, but also for Atticus himself.
The words that Harper Lee gave you and also Aaron Sorkin gave you for this are moving and poignant and funny at times.
Yes.
But this ensemble, these performances in this production, are
Dean, nothing. I love this. Is a wonderful company, and it's a deep bench. You know, it's so beautifully cast. And it is an ensemble because there's a sense throughout the entire play of the community of people that where Atticus and his family is living, and all the actors, the ensemble actors, the featured act, everybody helps bring it all to life. We sort of make the play, all of us together, and it's a wonderful experience for the ensemble to have, but it's also a fantastic group of actors. I mean, we have a great Chicago actress, Jacqueline Williams, of course, in the production, who is just a spectacular Calpurnia, and Melanie Moore is Scout, and we have, of course, Mary Badham in our company, and Mary Badham played Scout in the movie.
That's amazing,
originally, in the picture with Greg Peck, and she's so wonderful in it, and it's so great to have her with us. She's our great good luck charm to have her with us touring the country.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Greg Peck, as you call him. I love the familiarity.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I love that you feel close to him, but I wonder if it was intimidating at all taking on this role that he first brought to the screen as Atticus Finch.
No, not really. I mean, it was a different time. There were different styles of performing. It's in the nature, especially if you're a theater actor, as I have been my whole life, you know, taking on roles that have been played brilliantly by other actors is something that you just do. I mean, you know, I certainly wasn't the first actor to play Hamlet, but, you know, that doesn't stop you from doing it. The most important thing is to understand that the only thing you can really bring to a performance is yourself, and that's never going to be like anybody else. So, you know, people have asked me, what is it like to play this icon, you know, Atticus Finch? And I always say, well, you can't play, icons are unplayable. You can't play an icon. You can only play a person. And fortunately, Aaron has given Atticus such a human quality. He's taken him down off his pedestal and made him a man who is having a really difficult journey towards understanding, and so I don't have to worry about the iconic nature of the role or Gregory Peck's fabulous performance, which indeed, of course, it is. I just have to take the journey that Aaron has given me to take every night, and just do my best at that.
Yeah, I can't recommend it enough. I hope people will come and take a look. It's only here for another week in Chicago at the Niederlander Theater. I'll tell you what else has come up. I mean, I've talked about you being in To Kill a Mockingbird our television morning show and also here on the radio. And everybody is talking about, ask him about Ozark. He was so great in Ozark. This is the range of great characters that you've played throughout your entire career, really, right?
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be able to. This is why we want to become actors, actually, because as children, we want to be all these different people when we play. I think that's why they call us players. And part of the joy is to play these wildly different people. I would say that the Wendy's father in Ozark is kind of the antithesis of
Atticus Finch. Yes, that's what I mean. That's so different.
I know the creepy dad, as opposed to the terrific dad. You know, but that was a delicious part to play. It's a great show, Ozark, and to play with Julia Garner, to play with the wonderful Laura Linney. You know, I mean, it was such a pleasure, and those roles. Those bad guys are so tasty. I mean, they truly are. I have to say, it's a great joy to play a good man like Atticus Finch, and it's another kind of joy to play such a terrible person as Nathan Davis.
Yeah, I've talked to so many actors who have said they love getting their teeth into these just awful bad guys.
I mean, they're great. They're great fun to play, and also. And also they're interesting to play as an actor because, you know, you have to play a person. You still have to play a person. You have to figure out what this person wants, what makes this person happy, what makes this person sad and angry, and to try to play these bad guys as, you know, as people and as people who have needs and goals and frustrations and desires, and so you dip into your own psyche for those things, because believe me, we've got the dark in there as well as the light, and you just, you know, you sort of work that patch of ground, and it's very fruitful and very interesting.
I wonder how you feel about the way people are watching television now. You know, it's very different from the way we used to watch the Waltons every week. You know, the people are
yes,
watching
when
things.
When dinosaurs walk
here. Dinosaurs walk, right. The, you know, people are watching, you know, streaming these series now, and you can binge, a whole season in one night. I guess that's a good time for actors, right? There's so much more out there for people to watch now.
Oh, it's a terrific time for actors. There's so much product. There's maybe too much product, but I mean, there's so many different types of shows, and there's so many different platforms on which one can work. And I think it's just great for actors right now. It's a very fruitful time. So we're all reaping the benefits of that. I mean, it's a bit of a glut, you know. So I mean, when I was doing the Waltons way back then, and there were three networks, and you did a show, you know, I mean, when you got your share of the audience, I mean, it's like a third of the people in the entire country were watching you. Now, you know, the pie is cut into so many smaller pieces.
Right.
It's a little bit different.
Right.
But the opportunity for work is really terrific for actors. But I never want theater to get lost in the shuffle, especially drama. And that's why it's been so, I've enjoyed touring. You know, I was here with The Humans a few years ago and The 12 Angry Men a few years before that, because right. I love touring plays. They don't get toured enough, and going to see a drama is a wonderful alternative for people. I mean, I'm speaking to the preacher of the choir here in Chicago, because Chicago is one of the great theater communities in America.
Well, you know, even we said after... You know, we had to like sit in silence for a little while at the conclusion of Mockingbird, just to kind of absorb it and take it all in. But we all said how nice it was to have a nice, serious evening of an intelligent drama to sit with. Nothing against musicals, love musicals.
No,
but it's just nice to have such a variety. And you're right, we're lucky in Chicago to have so many choices.
Well, Chicago is one of the great theater towns, but for as you tour the country in cities not like Chicago, where the primary theatrical venues are the touring venues, you know, you understand that people are much more interested in seeing a play than you might think. And you know, musicals are absolutely fantastic, but they're not the only fruit. You know, there are other pleasures to be gotten in the theater, and it's a question of having people get used to it. But also, the subject matter of this play, the way that Aaron has dealt with it, and the amount of humor. I bet you're amazed at the amount of humor in the production.
Well, you know, I was.
Considering how serious the story is.
But I kept saying, there's Aaron Sorkin. There's Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, exactly.
He knows how to balance a story like that.
But if ever there was a show, to take around the country right now, this is the one. So it's been really a privilege to do it.
Yeah.
And the welcoming here, the welcome in Chicago has been wonderful. And I'm grateful for your kind words about it.
Well, we're grateful that, you would bring it. So how long are you on tour with this now? You're taking this to cities all over
We finished. We started, I don't know where we started. We started in March, 1st of March. We finished at some point, I think, in July of next year. It's long tour. It's a long road.
Wow.
But we're bringing it all around, and it's very exciting.
Very good. Well, we appreciate that. We always enjoy your performances wherever they are. And just one final question. How is it that you have managed to never strangle somebody who must say, "Good night, John Boy"? That must happen to you every single day of your life, I would think.
It does, and the reason that I have managed not to strangle anyone is that I love that part so much, and I'm so proud of that show, and it brought me so much pleasure and so much success, and I think it was such a good show that I'm always, especially at my age now, I'm always delighted and happy to be reminded of what a good thing that was.
I'm so happy to hear that you embrace it like that. So, you know, some people want to leave their past behind and forget what brought them to the table in the first place. But
that's right. That's right. And I have really nothing but gratitude for that show.
Yeah. Oh, it was a fantastic show. I mean, no question about that. But I know just how many times when I've mentioned that Richard Thomas is going to be on the show with us and somebody goes, good night, John Boy, to me.
Yeah, of course. So exactly. I'm so safe. It'll be on my tombstone, man.
That's Richard, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you enjoy.
Dude, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining us. To Kill a Mockingbird is over at the Niederlander Theater on Randolph Street and is playing here till May 29th. You can get ticket info at BroadwayInChicago.com. Richard, have a great day today. Thank you so much.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Trying to get you guys in the mood for the car broadcasting, the motor casting we'll have on next Sunday morning. Now, what time, Andy, you mentioned all that during the sports.
Yeah.
What time is all that going on now?
Well, today we have the qualifying continuing. Dane Neal's going to have a special starting at 1 o'clock today, and then the qualifying from Indianapolis at 2. And then next week is the running of the Indy 500 on Sunday, and it'll start a little after 10.
A little after 10, but Dane is going to have like a pre...
Yeah, he'll have a pre-show thing from Indianapolis between, in this time frame, from 7 till 10.
Right. Which means I won't be here.
And you will be missed. At least by me.
So will you guys. I'm hoping to be on my second or third Bloody Mary by 11 o'clock. I'm hoping that I've eaten so much celery out of my Bloody Marys.
There's cars going around a track, huh?
Oh, yeah.
What was that?
I hear buzzing in my head, all right. Yeah, that's going to be so. Shawnee, you're going to be here delivering the news because that's your assigned post.
Yes. Yes, I'll be here.
The news must go on no matter what.
I'm disappointed that you didn't play all of Ronnie and the Daytonas there, Little GTO.
I was trying to find some other car song. That's the only car song I could think of. There's Little Deuce Coupe.
How about Cars by Gary Numan?
Cars by Gary Numan. Okay. That's two.
The little GTO worked for me. It worked just fine. Yeah.
You can play anything.
Yes,
you buy.
I will be here.
You know what? I'm waiting for someone to text me and go, you know, they don't race those kind of cars at the Indy 500. Little GTOs wouldn't race in the Indy 500. Smart aleck texters.
Uh-huh. You can also play anything by the Cars.
Oh, see? Look,
yeah.
Now you're digging deep.
Yeah. Pink Cadillac.
Oh, Pink Cadillac. We need more car songs. Yeah. Need more car songs.
Who's Zoomin' Who?
That would be. That's the perfect song for the Indy 500.
There we go. There you go.
Because the one and only time that I ever went to the Indy 500, and I, you know, was like in the stands, when these cars go by, you'd think the building's going to fall down.
Yeah.
It's the loudest event that you've ever been to.
Wait till you walk under the track and with the pedestrian underpass going into the infield.
I know.
And the cars go above you. Talk about deafening.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. I recorded this myself out of my car this morning. This is me coming to work this morning. I'm psyched. I'm ready.
Did you ride your lawnmower to work?
That sounds like the car on the real McCoys.
Mom, what's the real McCoys? Uncle Dean, what's the real McCoys? Anyway, I'll be thinking about you guys while you're busy.
Yeah, we'll
working.
Be thinking about you too.
I'll be sipping a nice cocktail, I hope. Relaxing. Would you like me to call in? I could offer my automobile expertise.
That'd be great.
Yeah. You
know, I think Dane would appreciate
I'll
that.
I'll contact Dane and see if he would like me to help out with the broadcast at all. It's 11:11. I wanted to tell you about this amazing production that's going on in Chicago. We've got a lot that's going on stage in Chicago right now. But when we get Looking Glass Alice to return to Chicago, you have got to go and experience this. Talk about a show that's for the whole family. It is an adaptation of the Alice in Wonderland story, but told in the most imaginative, delightful way. And joining us on the phone line to talk about it is Looking Glass Ensemble member and the artistic producer of new work at Looking Glass, Kareem Bandelay. Kareem, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Dean. Thanks for having me on.
So explain, I was thinking about how do I describe this, and every time I would try to summarize this into a sentence or two, I would say to myself, well, that's not doing justice to how fantastic this show is. I mean, it's so imaginative and so creative. How do you describe Looking Glass, Alice?
I think you're right, Dean. There's no stand-in for actually experiencing the thing, but I would say probably it's about birth and becoming, transitioning and transformation. It's a 90-minute dream dazzle that sort of reminds us of...
Dream dazzle is good. Yeah, dream dazzle is good.
Yeah, that's what it is, I think, and it reminds us of the importance of engaging in some level of nonsense. You know, making time for play and making time for exploration. And, you know, the adaptation is it's a mashup of Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass and what Alice found there.
Yeah.
And was kind of, written as a love letter to, our adaptive director, David Catlin's daughter, Baylor. And at the top of this is why it's so great for families, and parents will see it from a completely different perspective as children, of course. But like, everyone can get into it. It's sort of his reminder to her to like take it one step at a time. I think, and not be in a rush to get to the end. You know, enjoy each moment of life. At the top of the play, you hear. You hear voices, children's voices, you know, reciting nursery rhymes and whatever. And those children are actually all the Looking Glass children over the years at a certain age. So all the children of our ensemble members, and my daughter's voice is in there. And it's really a beautiful expression from a father to a daughter.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, one of the things that I haven't seen this production, but I've seen Looking Glass Alice when it played in Chicago before, is that I felt like don't ever stop being a kid. Don't ever stop the whimsy and wonder. You know, don't let life get too serious on you that you forget to have imagination and creativity. What a gift to give to children. But, you know, these days, man, do adults need that as a reminder as well.
No, absolutely. I agree. It's easy to get locked into, you know, the serious nature of responsibility. And I'm not saying one should be shirking that, but you know, in my own life and in my own parenting, I find that when I relax and take time to play with them, the stuff gets done. The stuff gets done. It's not exact, but it gets done, and it gets done in the most delightful ways. Mm-hmm. And you know, the time we spend is actually more pleasurable. The time we spend is actually more meaningful to them than you know, moving from A to B to C. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, we haven't even mentioned that when you go to see this production, you're really sort of also going to see a circus-like performance as well.
Absolutely,
that is visually dazzling for you know, kids of all ages to come and see.
Yeah, Looking Glass has always been. Rather an exploratory company, steeped in a physical, visceral kind of aesthetic, and I think nobody exemplifies that more potently than David Catlin and his frequent collaborator Sylvia Hernandez de Stasi, who runs the Actors Gym up in Evanston. There's a way in which the circus acts are used as metaphor, much in the way that Cirque du Soleil does their stuff. You know, where it's not nearly, although actually watching people dangling from 20, 30 feet up, walking on stilts, on a rolling globe, falling off a ladder, you know, using body weight to make a caterpillar out of three individuals is in itself dazzling. But there's always a component of what is happening in the story. And I think that when Catlin and Sylvia come up with an idea, a sort of circus idea to express a moment, they are thinking, okay, this is the inner life of the character. The character feels like they're falling. So we should find some way to express that. That is visceral, visual, and nonverbal. And it turns out to be incredibly effective, actually.
Somebody on our text line right now just wrote in saying, we're going to see Alice today. I'm bringing my 2.5-year-old grandniece because wow. I know it will hold her attention. I mean, that's the thing about the show, that it's perfect for kids because there's stimulation going on everywhere. But a 2.5-year-old can enjoy it as much as, a grandparent can enjoy it.
There is something coming at you every moment. And that's the thing is, like, for the most jaded audience members to watch them go, whoa,
yeah.
is kind of a treat.
Yeah, I can imagine as actors and producers, you are definitely getting a visceral reaction from the audience. Looking Glass Absolutely. Alice is playing through July 31st, and you can get tickets at lookingglasstheater.org, theater spelled with an R-E, lookingglasstheater.org. And you do have to show proof of vaccination upon entry, so just be aware of that before you go there. I can't wait to see it again, Kareem. It's really nice to talk to you. Thank you for bringing the show back to town again.
Thanks, Dean. Of course, it's a pleasure to do it. We'll see you at the show.
See you then. It's Kareem Bandelay, who's with Looking Glass Alice. Wow, this Dr. Justin Levesay, who you just heard in that North Shore commercial, did a heart valve replacement on my mother. I want to say, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago? My mother was 94, and she had heart valve replacement surgery. And Dr. Levesay is like, your mom is a candidate for this, and walked us through it, and it turned out amazing. And he was great, and North Shore was great. So nice to hear Dr. Levesay on the commercials that are running here on WGN. 11:24. Dean Richards, Sunday morning, still to come for you this morning. You know her from My Greek Table on PBS. Diane Kochelis is the author of 18 Greek and Mediterranean cookbooks. I had the honor of cooking with her on WGN-TV Morning News the other day. She'll join us coming up after 12 o'clock this morning. Also, the cast of Downton Abbey talking about their brand new movie. But I know what a lot of you are going to be doing today, this weekend, next weekend. Getting out in that garden, getting things ready for summer that is right around the corner. And I wanted to get an expert on the show today to help answer some of your questions and to prepare you for what we should be doing now. And that's why we invited Lisa Hilgenberg, horticulturist with the Chicago Botanic Garden, to be on the show with us today. Lisa, welcome to WGN.
Hi, good morning.
Nice to have you with us. So
thank you so much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here. It's finally a nice spring day.
And it's a little nicer than it was yesterday at this time, yes.
Yeah.
I guess the big question, I'm going to open up the phone lines for people to call in if they have questions about, what to do in the garden. 312-981-7200, and we'll get to your calls in a minute. But let me just start off with this basic question. I see all the stores have their planting needs are out, the flowers, the vegetables, the fruits, everything's out there right now. People are scooping them up and putting them in the ground. I worry that it's a little too early. What do you think?
Well, you're right. I mean, plants have varying tolerances to weather, and I've become a nighttime temperature watcher. And so when nighttime temperatures sort of moderate at 50 degrees and above, it's safe to plant warm season crops. And so I'm a vegetable gardener, and so I'm worried about those tomatoes going in too early before, you know, the end of the month. And it's not quite time for some of that to happen. So we have a whole slate of cool season crops growing very well now, but be careful about what you're planting. As far as like trees and shrubs, though, what a great time. 50 is nifty. That's sort of a saying when it comes to planting trees and shrubs. So it's great for certain plants, but not for others.
Yeah. So, for example, what is safe to put in the ground right now?
Well, as far as vegetables go, I would say you could plant carrots and Swiss chard and beets and some of the crops that can take those dips below 50 degrees. I think it's going to be 42 tonight in Glencoe. So it's still really cold. And I think some of the warm season tropical plants, caladiums and arums and some of the begonias, beautiful impatiens and begonias for bedding out in your garden, it's too early for those plants to go in the ground. So be careful about what you're planting. There are ways to protect plants from cold nighttime temperatures. But and, you know, one thing that the botanic garden is an example of is just what you should have in your garden at this time. So we're hoping that all your listeners are going to stop by Chicago Botanic Garden and have a look at what we have in the ground.
Yes. Well, and also you have this special thing going on called Flourish, the garden at 50. The Chicago Botanic Garden is celebrating its 50th anniversary, which is
that's
something. So what kind of big doings are going on out there for Flourish?
Yeah, it's a very exciting time for us, and it's a joyous celebration. I mean, if you consider that the garden opened its doors in 1972 with one small greenhouse and one little garden area open to the public, now it's this big multifaceted organization, and we have 28 gardens and 4 natural areas. There's a plant science center and a learning campus in Glencoe, and we've spread out to 16 community gardens and farm sites around Chicago and Lake County. And so we've experienced this extraordinary growth over the last 5 decades, and now we're marking this really important 50th birthday celebration with Flourish, the garden at 50. And it's just a series of garden-wide events and pop-up events, nature-inspired art, interactive stories, and it's all about connecting people to the natural world, as we've done for the last 5 decades.
Yeah, the Botanic Garden's always been one of my favorite places, just to stroll and get ideas and so forth. But with this 50th year celebration, even more so to come and explore the expertise that all of you put together out there for our enjoyment.
Well, that's true. And I think, you know, this is even beyond, we've engaged a series of 10 artists from around the world, local, international and national as well, who have installed these magnificent, you know, sort of, there's an interaction between nature and art and human creativity that's happening at the Botanic Garden. And you can see these from the visitor center all the way throughout our property there in Glencoe. Patrick Doherty, who's a world-renowned sculptor, sculpts out of willow branches, and he has installed something called the Rookery, which is on the way down to the prairie, the Dixon Prairie at Chicago Botanic Garden. And there's a beautiful herbarium installed in the visitor center that is copper wire with hanging dried seed heads and flowers of plants that were grown at the Botanic Garden. So a lot of it is sustainable, and it's interactive, and it's just a whole lot of fun. People of all ages will enjoy it. It goes on through September 25th, and there are some, you know, these outdoor installations, but there are also some installations at our Windy City Harvest Farm on Ogden in Chicago. And there are some installations in our greenhouse galleries in Glencoe. And then there's this pop-up event series going on the second and fourth weekend of every month. And that's a lot of fun. So lots of surprise events.
Okay. Well,
and then, of course, we're...
Go ahead.
I was going to say we can talk more about it in just a minute. We'll explain more, tell you how to get more information. And I want to get to these phone calls and texts that are coming in for you, people getting ready to plant, and they've got questions for our guest horticulturist, Lisa Hilgenberg from Chicago Botanic Garden. We'll continue in just a minute. I hope at some point during the time trials they play this song. Chasing after someone. And I hope speed does well in the time trials today that you'll hear on WGN. Lisa Hilgenberg is on with us, horticulturist, Chicago Botanic Garden, answering your questions about planting. Going to give us more info on Flourish the Garden at 50. The Botanic Garden celebrating its 50th anniversary. Lisa, you ready to answer some questions?
Yes, bring it on.
Okay, we've got texters saying, I have always grown my tomatoes in a certain patch of my yard, and it's always yielded great fruit. For the last 2 years, practically nothing has come up. What's gone wrong?
Well, it's important to rotate crops around your garden, especially if you've had a troubled year. So many of the tomato diseases are soil-borne, and it's important to rotate tomatoes. And crop rotation means that we don't repeat those plant families in a certain area in 4 years.
Oh.
So that is what a farmer would use. We can do that in our home gardens as well. So if you're growing and you have a problem, rotate your tomatoes to another area.
Okay.
And then be careful not to plant too early. It's still too early for tomatoes.
Right. Yeah. As you said, should the soil be treated? Is there, you know, something you should do to the soil in addition to rotating your crops?
You know, I think one thought on mitigating a soil problem, if you have wilts, bacterial problems, is to grow a cover crop or an allium, like an onion crop. A carrot crop would be a wonderful crop to grow in those areas that you've had problems. Another idea would be to make sure that you're adding lots of organic matter and working that matter in with a pitchfork, aerating the soil, lifting and adding air, and not using a lot of chemicals. We're gardening organically at the Chicago Botanic Garden fruit and vegetable garden, and we use mechanical methods to, you know, we're not using any synthetic sprays or fertilizers in the fruit and veg. So it's important for home gardeners to just keep in mind that whatever they do use in the soil is going to end up in the food that they're going to eat. So that's a nice. Yeah.
So so organic additives to the soil, but also, you know, things that, you know, maybe in your kitchen that you get, you know, get them ready and bury them in the soil so they can decompose and give back to the soil.
Maybe a composting area would be a nice way to incorporate kitchen scraps from you know, things that you've used, the strawberry hulls and the citrus peels and apple cores and things can be composted in a pile, either a bin or a pile in an alley. And compost is a great additive to vegetable gardens.
Okay.
That's the first way to increase the fertility in your vegetable garden is to add compost.
All right. Very good. This is Nina. You're on WGN 312-981-7200, by the way, with Lisa Hilgenberg from the Botanic Garden. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Dean. Thanks a lot. And hi, Lisa. First of all,
hello.
I would like to congratulate everyone at WGN for a great programming and great hosts. And I have been a regular listener since 1980.
No, thank you.
And great job, you guys. My question is to Miss Lisa. I have a pawpaw plant. I have two, matter of fact, one in front and one in the backyard. And the blooms are beautiful. The flowers bloom beautifully during spring. Those are little purple little flowers before the leaves come in. But unfortunately, there's no yield of any fruit. I understand sometimes because of the wind and because of the birds eating them up, there are fewer flowers left, but there have been no fruit at all since about almost 4 years.
Yeah, what kind of plant did you say this was?
It's pawpaw, P-A-W, P-A-W.
Pawpaw. Pawpaw plant. What do you think, yeah. Lisa?
Well, I know that the pawpaw, Asimina triloba, is a native plant. It's a pawpaw tree. I suppose there are shrub forms as well. They are pollinated by flies, and so they need to have that cross-pollination between flowers. So you might try to help the plant along when you see those flowers in the spring. Try to take pollen and move it flower to flower.
I see.
But also between pawpaws. So if you have a second pawpaw somewhere in, you said you had one in the back of your garden.
Yes.
Move it from plant or tree to tree. That's a beautiful fruit that looks sort of like a half a banana, and it tastes like a strawberry banana. We have several different cultivars at the Chicago Botanic Garden, and I invite you to come and take a look at those.
Excuse me?
Yeah, no, she was just saying that she is going to come and look at them, yes.
Great.
All right. There you go.
So, Ms. Lisa, is there any, you're right, it is not a plant, it's a tree. It's around about, I should say, about 7-8 feet now. And the leaves are beautiful. It is such a beautiful plant. Everyone comments on that. They compliment it. The leaves are beautiful during the whole spring to fall. Do I have to fertilize them?
I would say no. I would say it would benefit from a layer of mulch under the drip line, and then I would just not fertilize. You could certainly prune it so it's sort of an open center plant, but it has that beautiful tropical leaf that dangles and moves in the wind. It's a beautiful plant. I would agree with you there. Good luck with your pawpaw.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'd never even heard of that. So interesting. Appreciate your call. A texter from the 217 area code in central Illinois says, I want to plant a colored cauliflower. I've seen that in the store where it's like purple and yellow. Is that a certain hybrid of seed, Lisa, that you would start with?
Well, that's a great question. Cauliflower is, there are some hybrid cauliflowers that are purple. There's one that's called Veronica, which is a beautiful sort of cone-shaped head of cauliflower. My tip for cauliflower growing is to start it in your basement under lights about the 30th of June and plant it out in the garden as a 4 to 6 week old small start, a little small vegetable start in about July 15th and then or to the end of the month, and then harvest it in the fall. Cauliflower does much better from midsummer, maturing into the cool of the fall, rather than planting it now and having it mature in August.
Okay. All right. Wow. That's late, it seems to me, but I guess it makes sense. 847 area code said they heard us talking about tomatoes. So when is it safe to plant tomatoes in our area?
I think the best way to make that determination is to watch the nighttime temperatures. Really become a weather watcher. And once we have a stable 55-degree nighttime temperature, that's the time to plant tomatoes. Because I need to make sure, you know, the 50 varieties of tomatoes are beautiful in the display garden, I wait until June 7th through 10th, something like that, to plant tomatoes.
Okay.
If you can protect them and pull the pot into your garage at night, sure, go ahead now. But otherwise, I would wait. If you're going to plant them in the ground, wait until it's about 50 degrees.
Okay.
And I invite you to come to Chicago Botanic Garden. We have, of course, we're planting gold and yellow tomatoes this summer because of Flourish, the garden at 50. And we have maybe 2 dozen varieties of yellow tomatoes that'll be grown. Well,
that'd be fantastic to see. We'll talk more with Lisa Hilgenberg, horticulturist at the Fruit and Vegetable Garden Center at the Chicago Botanic Garden. Right after this, if you want to ask a question, 312-981-7200. Dean Richards, Sunday morning, 11:52. My Greek table host, Diane Kochilis. She's written 18 cookbooks on Greek and Mediterranean cooking, as a favorite on PBS. Was in Chicago, joined me on our WGN TV news this past Friday. We cooked together, and she'll be joining us coming up at about 12:30 this afternoon. Hope you'll stick around for that. Right now, though, talking with Lisa Hilgenberg, horticulturist at the Chicago Botanic Garden, celebrating its 50th birthday with Flourish, the garden at 50. So many celebrations, special displays and things going on, celebrating their 50 years now, going on through September the 25th. And Lisa, more questions for you. Someone following up on what you were just telling us a moment ago about the cauliflower, about starting it a little late and not bringing it outside till then. But someone asking, does your cauliflower rule apply to other cruciferous vegetables at all? The broccolis, the Brussels sprouts, what else would be considered cruciferous? Cabbage, right? Kale, things like that?
Yes, it does. That's very astute. So I would say broccoli, certainly. I would treat broccoli and cauliflower the same way. I like the robs for spring growing. I think the broccoli robs do very well with that short season of cool weather. But our temperatures increase so quickly. You know, it's been 90 degrees already, and that sort of ruins your broccoli crop if it's growing in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that July 15th date for cauliflowers and for broccoli. Brussels sprouts, on the other hand, have a very long growing season. They need 110 days, some of them.
Oh.
So we start Brussels sprouts in the garden June 1st. And I think the tip for brassica crops is to make sure that they're actively growing. Take them from the plastic flat and put them right in the garden and keep them growing actively with lots of water. And then at the opportune times when cabbage is heading or when the cauliflower is getting ready to form its head, it's very important to keep them fertilized and watered. And by fertilized, I mean just a shovel full of compost underneath the plants or along the row would be perfect. Cabbage, on the other hand, I would say there are lots of different varieties of cabbage. So if you look in a seed catalog, you'll see early maturing varieties, the mid-season cabbages, and then the storage cabbages, the longer season cabbage. So choose the timing according to that. We grow those early small cabbages in the spring and then the main crop throughout the summer. So those very tightly headed sauerkraut-making cabbages can grow all summer.
Okay.
Vegetable gardening is all about timing.
Yeah, clearly. Having some knowledge about that, which people can learn at the Botanic Garden, is crucial. This is Pam at 312-981-7200. You are on with Lisa Hilgenberg from the Botanic Garden. Pam?
Hi. Yes, I bought a white-flowering hydrangea plant at a garden club sale. The garden clubs at the end of the year or whatever, at the beginning of the year or something, they dig up their stuff and they, do plant sales. So I bought this plant like 5 years ago, and it gets big leaves on it, and it's never flowered. I've never had any, it's never bloomed.
Hmm.
After I bought it, I read somewhere that certain hydrangeas need to be pruned in the spring and certain ones need to be pruned in the fall. And our landscaper, I know after I planted it in the spring, he did prune it in the fall. And I don't know if that's the reason why or even what I read was true. I don't know. It just never flowered.
Okay. Well, Pam, I think it's probably hydrangea arborescens, which is the Annabelle type of hydrangea. There are four different categories of hydrangea, all needing a little bit different treatment. And if it blooms, it doesn't bloom at all. It's likely it doesn't have enough sun. That could certainly be one problem. But Annabelles are pruned hard in the spring. So they bloom on new wood that's produced this summer. So we pruned ours in about March, and we took them down to about 12 to 18 inches, just above a vigorous bud. And so you can see where that new growth is going to push out as soon as the spring weather gets warm enough. So it's likely it's been pruned at the wrong time. I would say, choose the right kind of hydrangea. There are the panicle hydrangeas. There are the macrophylla hydrangeas, which are the beautiful blue and pink hydrangeas. And try another hydrangea. I think it's nice to have a multitude in your garden, and if you have space, hydrangea is a great plant. The oak leaf hydrangea has beautiful fall color, so there are lots of opportunities to have many hydrangea blooms.
Some beautiful,
I guess, is
beautiful color there. You can get more info on all of this plus Flourish the Garden at 50 when you go to chicagobotanic.org. Lisa Helgenberg, a horticulturist. Very nice to talk to you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dean.
As usual, when we have a horticulturist on the show, the phone lines go nuts. People wanting to get their questions, and we only had a limited amount of time. But check out the Chicago Botanic Garden if you want to get more information. Their staff are fantastic at answering questions. And we'll try to do that a little bit more this summer. We try to have experts on to answer questions and get all your gardening stuff straightened on. Have we ever talked about this with you? Do you have a green thumb?
No. I do plant things because I do have a nice patio outside and try to put some greenery out there. But
what have you planted out there?
Just basic petunias or
flowers.
Flowers, yeah.
Flowers.
I have not tried, tomatoes or beans or anything like that. But
Would you like to have that out there?
If I had more room, I would. It would be nice to do.
I did tomatoes in pots for the first time.
You did? Yeah.
I just wanted to try it and see.
One thing I did grow was basil, fresh basil.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Wow, what a difference.
Nothing better.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing better. My favorite thing to do in the summertime is to go outside and pick a couple of tomatoes, pick a cucumber, pick a green pepper, and I make a little salad of stuff that I picked out of the yard. The flavor is,
isn't that something,
a thousand times better.
Yes, it is.
I don't know what they're doing to the stuff in the store, but I'm sure they must. I don't know. I mean, it's I guess the way I'm doing it is more organic also, so it's probably a lot more natural and all that. But
well, you don't have the shipping. You don't really know how long that produce that has been in the store
sitting
there.
Around. But sometimes you get tomatoes and there's no taste whatsoever.
No.
But you go out into your garden and you pick a nice tomato and make a salad. Or I always put one plant of cherry tomatoes.
Oh, yes.
Because I love cherry tomatoes.
I love those, too.
And I'll just be in the backyard and pick a couple.
You can just eat them.
And eat them, right.
Yeah.
They're delicious. But they did great in the pot. I was very happy with all of that. So I recommend that to you.
Talk about a taste difference. I'll always remember the first time my friend in the New Buffalo, Michigan area, he and I went out blueberry picking.
Oh, yeah.
And I had never done it until several years ago. Talk about a taste difference between what we picked there. Right. And then he took me to a farm where we bought peaches that had been picked that morning.
Fresh picked peaches.
Out of this world.
Fresh picked peaches.
Out of this world.
You cannot beat it.
Mm.
Just for, a delicious snack. Or I made a cobbler.
Peach cobbler.
A couple of years ago, that was delicious. I've become a fan of all that, like the fresh picked, the stone fruits in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
You can't beat
plums,
that stuff.
Peaches.
Yeah, that's nice. But I like a nice farmer's market to let somebody else do the actual picking. Let somebody else do the actual work.
Good to see those back. Remember, 2020, we didn't have them
right. Because
of the height of COVID.
Right.
And good to see those come back.
My only problem with the farmer's market is I wind up, I get so excited about everything I see, I wind up buying too much stuff.
Yeah, and then it goes to waste.
Yeah, it's right? Like, well,
very tempting to get.
What am I going to do with 15 pounds of peaches now? Why did I go crazy with that?
Well, it'll be later in the year, but for me, I'll always find a good farmer's market to get Honeycrisp apples.
Oh yeah,
September.
You know this? What do they call it? The Green City Market.
Yes,
they have in Lincoln Park every Saturday morning.
Right.
It's one of the better farmers markets. We're lucky. We have very nice farmers markets around the Chicago area, and the farmers come in from Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, the surrounding areas, and they bring fresh picked stuff. But this Green City Market has such a variety of high quality stuff. I can't recommend it enough. You'll find me there often on a Saturday morning.
And do other people stay around once you're there?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you find
I make
you there
people leave?
Right. Hi, I'm Dean Richards.
Do I make people leave? You mean? I'm out there.
Did you see him over there?
You can get a nice fresh baked muffin and some coffee, and you stroll around.
And I'll bet they have apple cider in the fall.
They have apple cider in the fall. Of course they do.
Delicious. Yeah, delicious.
Nothing better than that.
Here's our new segment for the show now, the Green Thumb.
Well, I would love that. I would love nothing more than that because I do enjoy that almost as much as I love being on the grill. I'm looking forward to a nice grilling season this year. In fact, what we're going to do in a few minutes, we're going to talk with my Greek table host, Diane Kochelis. She's one of PBS's most popular TV chefs. And she does a show about Greek cooking. She was in town for the National Restaurant Show, came over and cooked with me on the WGN TV Morning News. You can see that on the WGNTV.com/DeanCooks. You can watch that episode if you want to. And I made Greek paella for her. The recipe is there. I think it turned out pretty delicious. The food went like crazy. Everybody loved it.
You said she liked it.
She enjoyed it.
Yeah.
She said she was going to steal my recipe. So,
if you see that in the next book, in the 19th book that she writes.
Yeah, I'm going to sue her. It's a shame. We had a nice friendship. But, business is business. You got to do what you got to do.
Sorry.
But, excuse me, I'm looking forward to doing some straight out grilling. So we're going to share the interview with Diane Kochelis coming up in a few minutes, and then I want to open up the phone line and just get some good ideas for grilling for the Memorial Day weekend next weekend. I do the same stuff all the time, but Jack, our new producer, Jack, I'm going to leave this up to you to find on our phone lines a fantastic recipe that we can do, that we can all do on our grills for the Memorial Day weekend. Does that sound good to you? Does that sound, you're going to go through the phone lines, scour the phone lines, find a good recipe, and we'll feature that recipe. We'll put the person on the air to give us the recipe. And this person, whoever gives us the best recipe, will get a $100 gift card from the Barbecue Authority in Lyle. How does that sound? Does that sound good to you, Jack?
Sounds good.
Okay.
You like to do fish on the grill, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Good salmon or...
did my famous...
rainbow trout.
My famous honey mustard salmon.
Oh, that's right. The honey mustard salmon.
I make that all the time.
Do you?
It's a major home run.
Mm-hmm.
It's delicious. I had some guests over. I made it. I grilled up some corn, did some my first corn on the cob of the season. That was good. But there's lots of good things to do. What's your favorite thing on the grill there, Jack?
Jack? Yeah. What's your favorite
Jack's
thing?
Favorite thing? We know so little about Jack. He's such a man of mystery.
I like it like that. No, I'm just kidding. I just like burgers, really. Okay. I'm simple.
All right. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with liking a good burger. But you're going to be the one. So you, though, are going to have to decide which is the best recipe that will win this gift card.
I'm ready.
All right.
I like to eat, so
all right.
I'm ready.
All right. We'll get to that coming up in a few minutes here. And when we come back from the break, talked with some of the cast members of this new Downton Abbey movie that is out in theaters right now. Such a charming, lovely movie. We'll talk with some of the actors when we come right back. WGN. Right now, though, I wanted to share with you something special. Some of my interviews that I did with the cast of the new Downton Abbey movie, Downton Abbey, A New Era. If you love the television series, if you love the movie that they put out in 2019, you're very definitely going to love this new installment that they put out. The original cast is back. A lot of new players and new plot lines and storylines are all back in this brand new movie. That is just, it's just a lovely movie. It is full of civility and warmth and charm and humor. There are some very touching moments in this film. And it is also one that even if you didn't watch Downton Abbey, the TV show, or the previous movie, you can, you know, just go into this and completely understand what's going on. It's still very, very enjoyable. Wound up giving it a Dean's List B plus, which is you know, a very good grade for a movie. So, if you're so inclined, I hope you will enjoy it. Two of the stars talked with me about the making of this movie: Elizabeth McGovern and Hugh Bonneville, telling me about the you know, what they think is behind the longevity of Downton Abbey: A New Era.
Well, I think that everything hangs on the script that you're working with. And I was so excited to read this one because I really felt that Julian had, he was on to something. He was channeling something that managed to preserve everything that audiences have grown to love about the characters and the story and give it something special. There's a frisson at play. And I really felt it when I saw the movie. It was as though the whole thing, it was reoxygenated and funny and sad again. And that is one of the hardest things to do, to keep something going for as long as he has. And when you've got that writing, it's easy for the actors because the writing does it for you. And I think people forget how much it is to do with the writing. You can't make up for something that isn't there in the writing as an actor.
That's on the page. Hugh, how about for you? What are the challenges of keeping your role fresh and vital?
Oh, I think they're not so much challenges as opportunities. And the fact that we are revisiting these characters after first creating them 12 years ago, it's all great credit, as Elizabeth says. It's really down to Julian Fellowes' energy and imagination, and to keep coming up with stories that engage us as actors to want to play them, and then ultimately for audiences to want to re-engage with them as well by coming to the movie house. In this iteration, it's been great for both Cora and Robert to not only travel to a different country, but to travel further in terms of investigating their characters for different reasons without spoiling it. They learn more about themselves as they go on these emotional journeys. So there's no doubt that, you know, for us personally, you know, for me personally, in this particular iteration of the story, it was fun, and it was a challenge in its own way, but it was just great to know that Julian was, you know, still able to create stories that our audience will engage with. And I think that's certainly been true in Europe, where the film's already opened, and fingers crossed it will do the same here.
Elizabeth, what do you think is the success of the secret behind the success of Downton Abbey, the franchise? What is it that powers this so effectively?
If I really knew, I would be the richest person in the world. My guess is as good as the next guy's, honestly. I think it's something about the fact that it's comforting and entertaining at the same time. And you somehow, at least toward the beginning, you could watch it and feel not guilty because there was a little bit of history that you were feeling like you were getting as well. So all those things combined, I think I think the fact that there's so many characters means that there's somebody for everybody. That people from all walks of life can find somebody to relate to, all ages, you know, a whole bunch of different factors. I mean, now I think people are coming to it because they're nostalgic for the way the world was when they first started watching the show.
Yeah, that's probably very true. Hugh, how do you describe the Maggie Smith experience? Is it as much fun as it is for us watching on our end?
Well, it's fun insofar as it's terrifying. I can remember feeling scared on the first day of filming with her, and I was scared on the last day of filming with her. Simply because her standard is, you know, it's impossible to match. She will do something, you know, within a line, within a take, within a, you know, within a thought that surprises you and just makes the line that Julian has created even more delicious. She's a remarkable actress, formidable, you know, of her generation, and that we've spent, again, it's a sort of the whole thing has been a pinch me moment. It's been a pinch me 12 years, I suppose, on and off. But to work with someone of her caliber, who's already, you know, who's won 2 Oscars and has had the career that she's had both on stage and screen, and for her to play my mum and to be part of our ensemble, I never thought she'd. I can remember when I first got offered the script, I said, who's going to play Violet? And they said, well, we're hoping to get Maggie Smith. And I said, well, dream on, mate. That's not going to happen. And she stuck with us. So to be part of, have been in her orbit for this long and to watch someone as smart as she is at work has been a real education as much as a pleasure.
Yeah, Maggie Smith is just delightful in this movie, as she was, throughout the 6 seasons of the television show and the 2019 movie. In my opinion, every time she is on the screen, she steals the scene, whatever it is. It is such a wonderful character, and she's such a wonderful actress. Highly recommending this to you. Downton Abbey, A New Era, Dean's List B+, and it is in theaters right now. And it looks like it's going to wind up being the number 2 movie of the weekend. Doctor Strange looks like it's headed to be the number 1 movie for the holiday weekend. Doesn't really matter because next weekend the new Top Gun movie comes out, the Tom Cruise sequel to his movie Top Gun, this one called Top Gun Maverick, which is spectacular, by the way. I've already seen it, and it's so much fun. I mean, it's got summer movie written all over it. I think you're going to really enjoy it. I'll tell you much more about it during this coming week, and we'll share interviews with the cast. But Top Gun is, going to be the number 1 movie for several weeks to come. All right, so the phone lines are open for you right now at 312-981-7200. Taking your phone calls for the best thing that you do on the grill. What's the very best thing that you do on the grill? Producer Jack is going to listen to your recipes. He's going to pick what he thinks is the very best one, and that person will get a $100 gift card from the Barbecue Authority in Lyle. We'll share that on the air as we get closer to the holiday weekend. And when we come back from updating the news, the PBS TV chef Diane Kouchelis from My Greek Table joining us. 12:37, Dean Richards, Sunday morning on WGN. I've been very lucky on this food show. I've been able to talk with some of my favorite TV chefs through the years, most notably the great Julia Child, but also Lydia Bastianich, one of my favorites, the great Rick Bayless here in Chicago. The list goes on and on, Joanne Weir. And this past Friday, I had the opportunity to talk with one of my favorites, who I watch every Saturday on WTTW, Diane Kouchelis, who hosts the show My Greek Table. She takes you all over Greece and prepares the foods of the different regions of Greece. Diane has written 18 cookbooks on Greek and Mediterranean cooking. We had her on WGN TV Morning News this past Friday, and she cooked a gyros bolognese, which was delicious, by the way, and I made a Greek paella,
kind of a, you know, Greek style and flavored paella using gyros. One of her sponsors is Grecian Delight Kronos Gyros. So we were trying to incorporate her sponsor's product into the whole thing. She was at the National Restaurant Show. We had a great time cooking. You can see those recipes. You can see us both cooking by going to the TV website, WGNTV.com/DeanCooks. So all of that is there for you. But after all the cooking was done, we had an opportunity to sit down and just chat. And I had the opportunity to welcome Diane Kochilis.
Thank you.
it's an honor to have you here. You're part of my Saturday ritual of watching the cooking shows. You and Lydia Bastianich are my companions.
Well, just to be mentioned the same breath as Lydia is an honor, too.
Well, so. you've written 18 cookbooks on Greek and Mediterranean cooking. Your show, My Greek Table, on PBS are staples now. How did you even get started with all of this?
I'm Greek. We cook. we're born with like a spoon in our hands. How did I get started? I studied journalism. I had studied something completely irrelevant to what I'm doing. Well, actually not, because I use my journalistic skills to research.
Of course.
My dad was a cook. Greek immigrant. That's kind of, we always had food in the family. My mother was half Italian, was 90 pounds her whole life, lived on Entenmann's crumb cake and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Ooh, sounds good.
Lived to be 95.
See?
But was not a great cook. She made a few good Italian dishes, but generally speaking, she wasn't into food. My dad, on the other hand, was a big garrulous guy who, you know, loved to have people over. And, you know, dinner, I don't know if it was like this when you were growing up, but we had dinner together every night, you know, 6 o'clock.
Yep.
We had to be at the dinner table. We could be out riding our bikes all over the neighborhood. 6 o'clock, we had to be home for dinner.
Yep.
And dinner was cooked, you know, it wasn't out of a box, it was real food. And anyway, I grew up in that kind of environment. And when I got older, I was the Watergate generation. So, you know, I wanted to be an investigative journalist. And then my Greek parents, when I suggested I would cross the country and end up in some small town as a newspaper reporter, they said, no.
Yep. Not crazy about that idea.
No, yep. You're not doing that. But I ended up actually going to Greece at some point. But I did work as a journalist in New York for a while, in editorial. And then I got kind of this fate, you know, driven lucky break. I was working at a cultural magazine, actually for doctors, and editing their food column. And the food writer at the time was pretty well known, a guy named John Mariani. And he was a big restaurant critic. I was in my early 20s. And he introduced, and I, one day over, you know, it was the era of like three martini lunches and caviar, you know, lunches or whatever. Remember those good old days?
I sort of remember those.
You remember that? We can still remember it.
Vaguely.
That's a good thing.
If I can remember it, I wasn't doing it right, is what they say, right?
But anyway, so he kind of, over one of those long lunches, I happened to mention that there hadn't been a Greek cookbook published in English in about 10 years. And I remember the book, the last book at that time, this was the sort of late 80s, was a book by a woman named Vilma Liakouras, and it was a very classic Greek cookbook, an excellent book, but it was out of print. It hadn't been in, you know, hadn't been, I guess, refreshed or whatever in a few years. And he introduced me to his agent. I wrote up a proposal. It took a year to sell the book. I got rejected by every single New York City publishing house.
Wow.
Until one, you know, said yes. And that was St. Martin's Press. And actually, I'm back with them again after it's sort of like come full circle. But yeah, that's kind of how it started. And then, of course, I didn't really know what I was doing. I'm one of those people who says yes to a project. And then
you learn how to do it.
And then I actually taught myself. This is really true. I mean, I could cook, but I really did teach myself how to cook while I was writing this book. Because we moved to Greece. I was married at the time. We were in our mid to late 20s. My husband was an artist, still is an artist, and all his friends were artists. And artists, as you probably know, are quite critical and demanding for mm-hmm. the most part. So I cooked for them every night. And I subjected myself to their critiques. But it was actually a great exercise because then I learned how to fix the mistakes.
Trial and error.
Yeah, trial and error.
That's so interesting because when I watch your show, it's so descriptive of not only how to prepare each ingredient to come to the final project, but the stories that you tell and the kind of adventures that you take us on leading up to a dish that you're preparing around the regions of Greece or you know, showing us video of it is, it's like going on a little vacation every week with you.
That's a great compliment. I mean, I have traveled a lot. I've been in Greece for 30 years, and I did one of my favorite books, and they're all favorite. They're all like, it's having, you know, you don't pick a favorite child, right? But one book that I did set out to write, and this was a classic example of biting off more than I could chew, was a book called The Glorious Foods of Greece, and I set out to document the regional foods of Greece. This was in the... That book came out in... It was 2001. And I traveled. That book took me 8 years to research.
Wow.
And I traveled.
Wow.
My daughter was a young child, and I took her with me everywhere. And I think half the times people just felt sorry for me because I was traveling alone. A woman alone in Greece with a young child was a really weird, was a very weird thing 20-something years ago. And people would kind of feed me, like, oh, this woman's out of her mind with this kid. But anyway.
Give her some food. It's so interesting, this book that you say took 8 years to cook. I found an early copy of this book in my mother's things when I was cleaning out her house. My mother really didn't cook from cookbooks ever. But she had your book, and on it she wrote... Excellent.
That was the Food and Wine of Greece.
The Food and Wine of Greece.
I remember the story you told me.
This was
a different book. This was several books later, The Glorious Foods.
Yeah, she commented on your book and how much she loved it. And then as I was looking at some of the recipes in the book, she changed some of the ingredients. She made her a few additions to the recipes. Diane Kochelis with us today on WGN. We'll explain why she's in Chicago when we come right back. 720 WGN. Created by another great Greek guy, Sam Sianis. Cheeseburger, 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 no chips, coke. Diane Kochelis, our guest on the program today, the host of My Greek Table on PBS on Saturday afternoons. 18 amazing Greek and Mediterranean cookbooks. We're going to put the whole interview up on the web, WGNTV.com. And you can see the segments that I did with Diane on television where we cooked for each other at WGNTV.com/DeanCooks. We've got the recipes there. We've got the video segments. The remainder of this interview, I don't think we're going to have time to squeeze in here before the end of the hour, because I wanted to get our contest winner in. Producer Jack has been screening phone calls for who is going to win this $100 gift card from the Barbecue Authority. And Lyle, Jack, what do we have going on here?
So after all the calls, I went with Mike with a grilled brisket, just the way he talked about it. It made me hungry. So
that's the key.
It made me hungry. So
yep.
Mike was my pick.
That's the key to a good recipe. Mike, you won over producer Jack on this.
That is awesome, man. I just I appreciate listening to your show, Dean.
Thank you.
You know, if I could give a few tips to the listeners out there, I'm happy to.
Excellent. So tell me, what is this grilled brisket recipe that? That you enticed our new producer with?
Well, it all starts with the meat, beef brisket, and preparing it, trimming off that fat cap down to about a quarter inch.
Okay.
And then giving it a good rub, you know, which I just use some basic ingredients you can find in any store, in the bottle. Paprika.
Yeah, there's.
But it starts with like yellow mustard base, and rub it down real good.
Okay.
And just, you know, paprika, grilled granulated garlic, onion, stuff like that.
Yeah, they sell pepper. They sell these barbecue rubs. There's a whole variety of them. If you don't want to make your own, you can make your own, but very easy to get a good barbecue rub. But you put some of the mustard in there too, huh?
Well, I put the mustard down so the rub sticks.
Got it.
And then just let it sit for 24 hours in the refrigerator.
All right. And then what do you do? Do you grill it or do you smoke it?
Well, I do both.
Okay.
But I use charcoal grill, the old Weber kettle.
Yep.
But what I do is indirect heat, where I take some old patio bricks and just put another rack on top.
Okay.
But keep it coals, or it could be electric or gas or whatever, on one side, and keep the meat on the other.
On the other side, right.
And now with the smoking of it, what I do is I use soup cans or tuna cans that are old, washed out, and just put the chips in there and the water in the other one.
Okay.
And that creates a smoke.
Yeah.
Now, how long? You can do that for like 3 or 4 hours,
I was going to say, how long do you leave it on the indirect heat? Like, probably like a medium indirect heat, right?
Right. I'd say anywhere between 210 to 225 degrees is where you want your grill set at.
Okay. About 3 hours. Three hours enough, you think?
Hour a pound.
1 hour per pound. Okay.
Right. And then you want to check it every half hour and make sure it's not getting too, you know, what they call the blackness.
Yeah, the bark. Yeah, you're right.
You want to cover that as soon as it starts to get good bark.
Yeah, put some foil.
So you check it every half hour.
Right, right.
And then, you know, from there, you take it off, and you can always put it in the oven for like 200 degrees and just wrap it up.
Yeah, just keep it warm in the oven until you're ready to serve it. But
it's just gonna melt in your mouth. You won't need a fork or nothing.
Right.
This is the toughest piece of meat you can cook.
You're right. You probably want to let it rest for a little while, 20 minutes, half hour.
Let it rest. I even stick it in the fridge.
Oh wow.
Let it get cold and then slice it because it's easier to slice when it's cold.
Okay. All right.
And then you can reheat it. Like an hour before, 200 degrees, wrapped up in foil.
Put a little barbecue sauce on there?
Whatever you want. I mean, hot sauce, barbecue sauce, whatever you want.
That's a good recipe. You know? Hey, I'm going to send you a $100 gift card, Mike, for the Barbecue Authority in Lyle. You can go to barbecueauthority.com to learn more. But we're going to send that out to you. That's a fantastic recipe for someone to try. I think I'm going to actually give it a try. I've never done brisket on the grill. I'm going to give it a try this holiday weekend. I appreciate your call. I'm all out of time. You have a safe weekend, and everybody have a wonderful Sunday.